This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is the executive director of the Jewish Federation of, is it Champaign County?
It's Champaign-Urbana.
Champaign-Urbana.
Jewish Federation, and the area of coverage is, I would say, about a 60-mile radius around Champaign-Urbana.
So beyond the county lines.
We include Rantoul and Mattoon-Charleston, Danville.
And Dr. Lee Malhado has been the director for how many years now?
11.
11 years. And at the annual meeting just a few weeks ago, you sort of gave your goodbye speech because you are choosing to be retired at this young age. And after 11 years, let's talk a little bit about the Jewish Federation. What are some of the things you're happiest about as you look back on your tenure as director?
Well, one is very personal and perhaps selfish, but I think I've done a lot of different things in my career. I was a chemist. I've been a technical writer. I ran the radioisotope lab on campus for a while. I was an emergency psychiatric social worker at the mental health center, working very intensively with children and families. And I was director of psychiatric services at the Pavilion for 3 years. So I've done a lot of different things. But of all the things I've done, I think I've appreciated serving the Jewish community as executive director of Jewish Federation the most.
So what made it the most rewarding?
Two different factors. One has to do with the value of the work itself. It's just very meaningful to me to be able to help people both in the abstract by helping the community raise money and send it to agencies that really help people, and also direct service. We do direct service here in town. We help people in need, and we run programs that are community building within our own community and that span the communities. Also, we reach out to the community around us as well. And I find that role of helping others and building community meaningful to me. In another way, I appreciate it because I think of all the different things that I've done. It uses the most of what I have to give, what God put me here to do, if you will, that I have a lot of skills that are analytical and numerical and technical, but I also have a lot of skills that deal with working with people. And this job allows me to move freely between those roles every day, and I like that.
Tell us about some of the direct service that the Jewish Federation has done here in the Champaign-Urbana area over these last 11 years.
Well, one of the oldest is Holocaust education. The organization has sponsored Holocaust education in this area for 30, 40 years. And speakers go into schools and work at all – at 5th grade, 8th grade, and 11th grade. Those are the state-mandated ages. More recently, I would say for the last 7 or 8 years, the committee has worked very intensively on training teachers how to do this because in the old days – it was done mostly by bringing in survivors,
sure,
who would be speakers in the classes and give first-person accounts of what their own life experience was in the Holocaust. But more and more Holocaust survivors are dying, and those that remain are frail. So to pass along the knowledge and the experience of against genocide generally, not just against the Holocaust, but against genocide of all types, you have to train people to do it. It's not intrinsically obvious how to do this. And some people are very intimidated by the subject and feel really uncomfortable teaching it. So the committee has worked very actively to do that. There are a lot of other things, too. Would you like me to sort of go on?
Well, let me follow up a little bit on that first. I'm just wondering if you have, for our listeners and for me, a book and a film, perhaps, on the Holocaust? particularly
there
recommend?
There are so many.
There are so many. Some that have risen to the top in your experience.
Well, Schindler's List is probably the one that's the best known and has been seen by many, many people. What's age appropriate is different
difficult.
Too.
For adults, certainly.
I would recommend that, and teenagers as well.
And Night and Fog.
Also an excellent movie, but I would not recommend that for older teens.
Sure.
It's too traumatizing.
Too graphic.
Yeah. But there are a large number of resources that our organization has provided at the Champaign and Urbana libraries, hundreds of books and CDs and movies that are in their collections. So to go to the reference library and ask, there's plenty.
Mm-hmm.
And schools can also get whole collections taken to the school. We have these things called trunks, and there's a trunk for each age group. So a school can request a trunk, and then they have hundreds of things to choose from in the trunk.
And this is another project of the Jewish Federation.
Right, right. All of these are things that the Holocaust Education Committee has done over the last 30, 40 years.
Right. And although you will not be there as director too many days longer, how many people contact the Federation even after you're gone? The phone numbers, websites?
Oh, sure. The phone number is 367-9872.
And that's 217-367-9872.
The email is our initials. It's cujf@shalomcu, all one word.
shalomcu.
.org.
Okay, great. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the other direct services.
Okay.
I know there are many.
One of the ones that I started was a group for seniors, a committee for seniors, and they have two different programs. One is a program, a weekday program for seniors. It has run between 4 and 6 times a year. It doesn't run every day or anything, but they have topics, speakers, and activities that are sort of a mixture of recreational and social and educational at the same time. Between 40 and 60 people from the community get together, not all of them Jewish, the majority Jewish, but it's open to everyone. And we'll have a specific activity or a speaker and a meal or a dessert. Sometimes it's a meal, sometimes it's a dessert. And people really seem to enjoy it. They often stay for longer than the program was intended to run for. And they enjoy talking to each other as much as they enjoy the activity itself. We also take packages into nursing homes and homes where people are homebound or if they've been recently bereaved. Sometimes we do that too. To let people know that even though they may be ill or isolated in some way, that the community cares about them and remembers them. And the purpose of the package is not merely to provide them with a reminder of the holiday, but also to provide an opportunity for visiting by the volunteers who are bringing the items to them. And that's a program that had been, both of these programs had been needed for a long time in our community. People had talked for about 10 years about what can we do for seniors, what can we do for seniors.
Sure.
And I started these. We have another part to this where we have some in-home services for seniors or some transportation for seniors to medical appointments or shopping or other kinds of company in their home. But we can only do that when we have interns, and we only have interns about half of the time. We don't have the manpower to do that on an ongoing basis.
How big is your office?
How big is my office?
How many people?
I'm full-time. There's one other full-time person who does the bookkeeping and who is our Russian-speaking specialist, and I can talk a little bit more about that in a minute. And he does some of the human service delivery for another committee that we have as well. And he also works with the seniors. Then we have a quarter-time person whose responsibility is our weekly email and our monthly newsletter and just beginning to work on the website. We've tried to do the website with volunteers for a long time, and it doesn't work. I'm hoping we can get her a couple hours a week to do the website.
And then volunteers? committees?
Oh, yes. There's about 10 committees, and the committees are run by volunteers, and there are hundreds of volunteers involved during a year. We could never do what we do without the volunteers.
How big is the Jewish community in the Champaign-Urbana area, this 60-mile radius?
There's about 600 families, and a fairly large proportion of those families are only one or two people. The average, well, I won't say the average age. Yes, yes, I can say that. The average age is around 60, and one-third of our population is over 65.
And that's something new in the Jewish community in this country generally, probably, isn't it?
Well, our community is diminishing in size locally, and that's a new trend that's just started to happen in the last 3-4 years. We were, for a long time, the only downstate Jewish community that was growing, but we're no longer growing. We're beginning to contract and definitely aging. And that's a result of many things, one of them being the tendency of Jewish families to be very highly educated. They really, really value education. And along with that usually comes smaller families. So there's not a lot of younger kids coming in to the population. And the other is intermarriage, that more than 50% of Jews in the United States are marrying non-Jews, which reduces the – only about a third of those wind up being raised Jewish if they have children.
Mm.
So – the population, I think in the 50s, the population of the United States was approximately 5% Jewish, and now it's definitely less than that. It's hovering around 2-2.5%. And in Champaign-Urbana, it's even smaller. It's between one-half and 1% of the area population.
And we're talking in the United States a total Jewish population of...
It's highly argumented, depending on whether you
how do you define
who's Jewish, how active they are, and how they consider themselves. But it's estimated by two different recent population surveys to be between 5 and 6 million.
Mm-hmm. And there are about that many Muslims in this country now, I believe.
Yes, yes, and I think in Champaign-Urbana, in the last couple of years, my guess would be that the Jewish community is now slightly smaller than the local Muslim community, because the Muslim community is growing and very young.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Lee Melhado, who is the about-to-retire executive director of the Jewish Federation of Champaign-Urbana and vicinity. And she's served 11 years. If you have a question or comment, this is a live call-in show, and we're delighted to have people join in this conversation. Do call us. If it's a local call, 333-9455. If it's long distance, you may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And I should just remind you what Jay Pierce said just a few moments ago as our show started, that there is still time to pledge before the end of our fiscal year here at WILL. And if you appreciate this program and the many programs here on WILL, go to your computer and you can do it online at willpledge.org, willpledge.org, or you may call a number that's always available to make a pledge, and that's 217-244-9455. So I've given you a lot of numbers, but it's for a worthy cause, and I do encourage people who listen to WILL to support it. We know only about one person in 10 who listens regularly actually makes any contribution, and we'd sure like to see that number increase. So 244-9455 to pledge, or willpledge.org, and to join the conversation here with Lee Melhado and myself, do call us at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And that includes people who are listening online, of course. And if you've missed part of this program or have missed other programs you'd like to look at, we are available archived at will.illinois.edu. Go to AM and go to Keeping the Faith. You'll see the list of our programs. Or you can just type in the search for the name of the person or the topic, and it'll pop up for you, and you can listen at your convenience via your computer. Well, back to Lee Malhado. Lee, you have a doctorate in what scientific field is it now?
I have a PhD in organic chemistry.
In organic chemistry. And how did that train you to be the director of the Jewish Federation? What skills did you bring from that?
Well, a lot. Yeah, I do the budget. Yeah. I do the annual report. I have to know about numbers.
Sure.
I'm not trained as an accountant, but I know about numbers.
Sure.
One of the things you do in chemistry is you budget your projects, and you have to figure out how much the materials cost that you're using, and is it cost effective to make this compound and stuff like that. So I know about budgeting. I also ran the radioisotope lab, which had a budget. Chemistry is about tough problems, and you have to define the problem.
Analyze it,
figure out how to work it through. Most chemistry is done in teams, and most chemistry is extremely competitive on the national and international level. So it's not just about the compounds you're making or the goal. It's also about how people interact, and there's a lot of politics involved in that. So how to do all of that.
Politics and religious organizations? You're surprising me here.
I'm sure the politics in most religious organizations are very, very similar. Yeah. And I think above all, I learned in chemistry how to be a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that really helped me. A lot of people in social work are thrust into management without any training, and a lot of people in Jewish communal life are thrust into management positions without any training, although that's changing. There's more and more official training for people in Jewish communal service.
Let's get to your social work background in a moment, but we do have a caller on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I wanted to ask Lee to talk about something that I've noticed, and she might, this is apropos your comments, Lee, about the population in terms of Jewish population growth. And you were talking about smaller families. Now, I know that's probably true in the Champaign-Urbana area, but one phenomenon that I noticed was also the very large Jewish families in Orthodox Jewish communities, particularly in Hasidic or extremely Orthodox, where the community, where average population families are 10, 12, or even more, and that marry very early, so their population growth is actually quite phenomenal. It's certainly something which I can document because through personal connections where Jewish communities have to constantly be expanding on the East Coast because they outgrow even their, the projections of growth when they create new communities in around New York City area. So I wonder if you could talk about it. I know it's not just the New York City area. This is other areas, too. So I wonder if you have statistics on that.
I have something I can say. I don't know if I'll answer all your questions about it, but the population growth or the average family size in the Reform community is under 2, which is under replacement, significantly under 2. It's one of the lowest ethnic population rates in the United States. It's around 1.6 or 1.5.
And the Reform Jewish community is the largest.
Is currently far and away the largest of the branches.
Shrinking the fastest.
Shrinking the fastest, yes. Conservative is somewhat larger. Modern Orthodox average family size is right around 4.
Right.
So it's significantly larger. And ultra-Orthodox, the families are significantly larger. The average is around 8.
Okay, so the
averages are quite different. However, in the United States, the Orthodox community is only about 12%, 10 to 12% of total. And the ultra-Orthodox in the U.S. is really tiny, like 1 or 2%. So, yes, those groups do grow. And I think with time may represent a larger proportion of the Jewish community, especially since so many of the Reform are marrying out.
Right.
But it would take a lot of growth over a long period of time to dramatically alter the total perspective, which is that there were around 5 million Jews in 1950 in the United States, and there's still around 5 million Jews in the United States, although the population of the United States is now double what it was, right. what it was in 1950.
I wonder if there's underreporting for the ultra-Orthodox, one, because of their hesitancy to participate in the modern, what should I say, modern worlds, to the extent that they stay out of schools, they stay out of social systems where they're reporting, they have their own schools, their own communities, and they resent intrusion by governmental and academic organizations.
I'm sure this is part of why there's argumentation over the two surveys that were done in 2000.
Right.
And I'm sure this is one of many distorting factors. But still, the ultra-Orthodox in the United States do not exist outside of about 8 or 10 cities in any significant degree.
But they have this phenomena, and I don't know how well it documented is, where they create communities, that they buy up land and create their own communities, very much like the Amish, where it's just ultra-Orthodox. They don't let other groups in. They don't let other Jewish groups, much less other non-Jewish groups. They own the land. They create their own towns, and they just expand. And these towns have been having to create children towns, so to speak, because they literally outgrow their space, even though they have houses where there's families, as I said, of 7, 8, 10, 12, etc. And they tend to marry somewhere between the age of 18 and 20, and that's just the standard, which is very different than the norm in Jewish communities as a whole in the United States, and very different as the norm of the general population. So anyway, that's my own. This is to a certain extent anecdotal, but I think it's well documented to the extent that it could be documented.
Well, thank you very much for raising those points. Lee, anything else you want to say in response to
issue? I think there's truth to what he has to say. Kiryat Yoel in the New York area is probably the best example that I've read about. But still, if you're less than 1% of the total population and you double, it's still only 2% of the population. And there are really very few cities, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., Boston, Baltimore, maybe a few others besides those. But it doesn't affect the big picture. It affects the Orthodox end of the world. But as I said, that's only 10 to 12% of the total in the U.S.
We're talking with Lee Malhado, Executive Director of the Jewish Federation of Champaign-Urbana. And encourage people to give us a call. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455 if it's long distance or if you're listening on the internet. Lee, tell us a little bit about your background as a social worker after your training as an organic chemist. How did you make that switch, and did that require more schooling?
Yeah, I went back and I got a master's degree between 1986 and 1990, while I was still working full time. That was a real trick. It was convenient because the radioisotope lab was right across the street from the School of Social Work. So,
and why did you want to do that? And you were raising a couple kids at the same time, right?
Yeah. I guess you could say I was crazy. No, I think it was midlife crisis issues about what the value of work really is, and the difficulty of trying to be a dual career couple in a small town. Now, I got here in the 70s when spousal hires were not even considered. I was lucky enough to get a postdoc with a really brilliant man, Dr. Nelson Leonard, now deceased. loved working for him. But I was a postdoc for 7 years.
Yeah.
And enough is enough. There's just...
Your husband was the head of faculty position.
Right. So that's how I got the position as radioisotope lab director after that. But then I knew they were going to close the radioisotope lab because the nature of isotopic chemistry changed. It no longer was something that you needed to do in a specialized facility. It was something that you could do in very small quantities in your own lab. And there were over 468 labs on campus when I left. They were already having their own radioisotopes in their own lab. They didn't need a centralized facility anymore except for very, very high level levels of radioactivity or isotopes that were extremely dangerous. So I could see the handwriting on the wall. And I had done a lot of volunteer work for Crisis Line, for people in the lab who were troubled. And the faculty kept coming to me about what to do about this person who's suicidal and how do I refer this person out. And I thought, if I'm going to be doing this, I ought to be trained. I mean, I don't want to be messing people up. The more I thought about it, the more it seemed like a change in careers might be worth doing. And I think the disadvantage of being a woman in those days I've described, but the advantage is that people didn't think I was crazy. I think if I had been a man with a PhD in chemistry, leaving chemistry at the age of 40...
To get an MSW.
To get an MSW, people right. would have thought I lost my mind.
Yeah.
But as a woman, people just saw it as they understood the bind I was
sure.
in, and they could see the value in trying to do something that was maybe more available in this area.
Where was your PhD from?
Washington U. St. Louis.
Great school. And then an MSW from the U of I, and then you started doing psychiatric social work.
Right. That's what I wanted to do.
That was your focus.
Right. And what's funny about it is that everything I do, I wind up in administration. I wanted to be a bench chemist, and I wound up running a lab. I wanted to be a clinician, and I wound up as a manager. So when I went into the Jewish community, I knew that I was going to be in management. That was clear. I thought, you know, somebody's trying to tell me something here.
Now, you yourself are Orthodox. Your family is Orthodox.
Well, my husband describes himself as observant.
Observant.
My younger son describes himself as Orthodox and has since he was fairly young.
Okay.
My older son is militantly anti-religious.
Okay.
And I describe myself as sort of conservadox, sitting on the fence between conservative and orthodox.
Okay. And for our non-Jewish listeners, what do some of those terms mean?
Well, the Jewish spectrum, not all Jews are alike, as we have been talking about. And there's a spectrum of Jewish thought and practice which goes from the extreme fundamentalist in the same kind of terms that you would use in Christianity.
Or Islam.
It has to do with the view toward scripture and the view toward behavior. On the far fundamentalist side would be the ultra-Orthodox and then the Orthodox and then the modern Orthodox. And they would believe that Scripture is the divine word of God dictated to Moses, and they would believe that it's constant for all time, and they would be more apart from other cultural trends. I wouldn't say isolated in the modern Orthodox or even the Orthodox, but ultra-Orthodox, most are relatively isolated. Then you move into conservative, which is, yeah, Scripture is divine, but it's interpreted by people, so there's some room for alternate changes, and the behavior changes over time. It changes very, very slowly and as a community, but it changes, and then you move into reform, which is Scripture is written by human beings, maybe divinely inspired, but certainly each generation has to interpret it for themselves, and indeed each person has to interpret it for themselves, and that the laws that were set down biblically are no longer true in today's society. And then you can even move further along and become sort of humanistic, or you kind of plop over the edge when you become totally assimilated. But that's the basic viewpoint.
Some of this.
There's some other definitions. There's traditionalists and Reconstructionists, but I mean, this is like the topic of
this
a whole talk.
Enough, for sure. Talking with Lee Melhado here on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for the program. I might mention that this is the end of a pledge drive. By Tuesday night, we're trying at WILL to raise $126,000 more to try to bring the kind of programs next year that you've grown accustomed to and we know appreciate. So if you'd like to make a pledge, willpledge.org via your computer. You may call, you may access a way to pledge online, or you may call 217-244-9455. Coming up on Keeping the Faith in the next few weeks, we'll be talking with, Don Mason about Ghost Ranch Conference Center out in the West in July. In August, Laura Wetzel about International Friends here at the University of Illinois. Jack Good about the emotions and values of Jesus. In September, theologian Bob Caffey in the Christian tradition will talk about God in post-liberal perspective. So we have quite a few varied guests coming up. We know you'll be looking forward to. Lee Melhado recently found out that she received an interesting Interfaith Leadership Award. She will be receiving it this September from the Intercultural Friendship Foundation, a Muslim group here in Champaign-Urbana. And she is the honoree for this year for her leadership and interfaith relations. So congratulations, Lee, for that.
Thank you.
And I know as part of that you'll be giving a little speech, and they'll be giving a nice dinner in your honor. So, and that comes up September 9th, so people might want to note that on their calendar. And information will be coming out later about the details. But it'll be sometime the evening of September 9th. Let's see. I recently took a trip with a college friend on motorcycles. And for 5 or 6 days, we were driving around the Midwest. And one of our stops was at my college friend's home of one of his friends, a couple. And they have recently become vegan in terms of their diet. So they're not only vegetarian, but they also don't eat any eggs, milk, things like that, cheese. And the woman, as she was explaining her sudden choice, was doing it mainly for health reasons. But she also quoted from the Jewish Bible, from Genesis, the first chapter, I think it's verse 26 or 27, 28, somewhere in there, where it says, and God, after God had created humans, he said, here's what you'll eat. You'll eat the seed-bearing plants of the field, and you'll eat the seed-bearing fruit from the trees. And this will be what will sustain you in your life. Now, people who don't know much else about Jews know that many of them keep kosher. And you just mentioned that Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox would interpret the Bible literally. What do they do about this? She said this was obviously a vegan diet.
Well, the Bible—
That's different than kosher.
The Torah is seen as having historical development, a chronological historical development.
Okay.
And in the beginning, at creation, that's true. That was the prescribed diet. But that changes later on. I mean, if you read about Abraham welcoming the guests, for example, they're eating meat. And interestingly enough, they're eating milk as well, milk curds. But it's notable that the milk is served before the meat.
separate as
separate.
As
yeah, and the deal is with meat and milk that you can serve dairy before meat, but not the reverse. And you wouldn't eat them at the same meal, but you can have a glass of milk and then you can go have dinner with roast, but you don't do the reverse anyway. So the text of the scripture itself says that a vegan diet is what starts out, but then God grants permission to humans to eat meat as well. So that's how they would explain that. Now, it turns out that some Orthodox families are vegetarians also, for reasons which relate sometimes to their beliefs, that part of kashrut, or keeping kosher, has to do with caring about animals and treating them humanely. Mm. And so some people maintain their kashrut as vegetarian because they don't want to be killing animals, even though they're allowed to, as long as they're killed humanely. Mm. And other people do it because keeping kosher is tricky and difficult and complicated.
Yeah.
And sometimes households just find it a whole lot easier to have a vegetarian household, and then it's not as complicated. It's very easy to do.
But most Jews in this country being reformed would say those were rules perhaps for that time for various reasons, but for today we can eat almost anything.
Well, it's interesting. You might think that, but even the Jews who don't maintain kashrut, very few Jews eat pork.
Really?
A lot of them still maintain the prohibition against shellfish, although that's less common than the one against pork. And some of them won't eat meat and milk, even though they don't keep kosher in any other way.
Interesting.
Than not eating pork. So each, for as many... Yeah, there's as many ways to keep kosher as there are Jews, at least. Many different attitudes.
Let's get back to some of the things about the Jewish Federation, since you'll be retiring very soon. Has the new director to replace you been selected, or is there a process in place?
The process began in September of last year, and we do know who will be replacing me. Her name is Sabina Bruckner. She's coming from New York. And she will be here for her first day of work on July 5th.
And will you overlap with her a bit?
Or? Yes, I'll be there for a week full-time and for some time after that part-time. And she and I have to work that out.
And what are your plans after you get fully retired from this position?
Well, my biggest plan is in the beginning to have no plan.
Okay.
I want to just relax and decompress. This is a very demanding job, lots of hours and lots of politics and lots of stress. I love it, but I need a rest. And I have a lot of things I'd like to do, everything from refinishing furniture and gardening to maybe playing the trumpet again after 50 years. I mean, I have all kinds of some silly and some I'm sure I really will do. But I don't want to make commitments immediately upon retirement. I want to give myself some time.
And perhaps another graduate degree.
I'm not going back to school.
Not again. Okay.
I was getting my PhD in chemistry, took 6.5 years, and it took me 4 years to finish my social work degree because I was doing it part-time. So I think I've been in school long enough.
But knowing your intellectual curiosity, you may sign up with OLLI, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute or something.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Or perhaps teach some.
That's possible also.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what was the most challenge, what were some of the more challenging things about your work with the Federation? We've just touched on a few of the things you really were involved with, but like where do politics come in? Deciding what to do with the limited amounts of money is always a challenge.
Oh, that's a huge challenge. That's a huge challenge. Deciding how to spread very limited resources over huge needs and huge wants is very tricky. And that's not a decision I make totally by myself, but that decision is really made by an allocations committee, which is highly representative of our community as a whole. We have a lot of different interest groups and opinions and attitudes. So there's usually 8 or 10 people on that committee, all specially selected from different quarters of the community. And they make the decisions about how the money will be divided. But my desk is where the arguments occur.
Sure.
And I get the emails and the phone calls and the one-on-ones where people are expressing their views. Part of the difficult...
The passionate people.
Yes, the passionate people. Part of the difficulties have to do with the sheer number of things that we do. I mentioned Holocaust education and seniors, but we also have a very active human services program. I mentioned that we have a Russian-speaking specialist, and that's because we have a refugee resettlement program, and most of the people we resettle are from the former Soviet Union, although the last family that we resettled were Baha'i from Iran. We have an active burial society. We have an active Jewish Community Relations Committee. That's how you and I met, is through a lot of the interfaith work. We work with other churches, congregations. We work with government. We work with schools. There's a lot of stuff that goes on with the community. And some of the time, it's straightforward and educational, and people are seeking our input, asking me to present at a church or in a classroom. But sometimes the interactions are very fraught. They may have to do with anti-Semitism. It might be in the media. It might be graffiti on our building. It might be skinheads in the building who've been intimidating and threatening. I mean, it can be all kinds of things. Some of the stress has to do with the human services delivery in our human services committee. We serve people who are in pretty severe crisis, emotional or financial or both.
And not just Jews.
Not just Jews. And some of the – we deal with a number of transients, and some of them are quite tricky. How to help them in a way that's safe or reasonable. And it can produce problems with the organization that we are lucky to be hosted by. We don't own our own building. We're on the second floor in the Cohen Center.
Where Hillel is on campus.
Right.
Yes.
Hillel serves a very large Jewish student population. There's 3,500 Jewish students on campus, approximately. And many of them use the building, and there's lots of programming going on for students there. And the staff is not trained in human services, and they don't know how to handle some of the people that come to our building to work with us. They're frightened of some of these people, and they don't know how to work with the students to help the students feel comfortable.
Sure.
And that can produce friction between our organization and the organization that hosts us. And there's just all kinds of ways. There are a lot of arguments about the relative importance of serving the needs of Jews in Israel versus serving the needs of the local Jewish community. And that's an argument that oscillates up and down depending upon the political situation in Israel at a particular time. I mean, we don't do anything political. Everything that we do is humanitarian, charitable social services, but the politics get entrained in people's attitudes. There's arguments between the old and the young. What kind of programming should we be doing? How should we be doing it? How should we be fundraising? Should the newsletter be online or printed? I mean, you name
it.
Or
both, yeah.
Or both. There's a way to create controversy on almost any subject you choose.
Sure. And different opinions.
Different opinions, different people. Lots of the opinions are very, very valid. I don't mean to say that one view is right and one view is wrong on any of these topics. But
you have to make a decision.
But yeah. My office is where the people bring the problem, and I'm usually the one that has to deal with it. sometimes I'm the one who makes the decision. Sometimes I seek the input of the executive board or the board as a whole. It's a lot of stuff to juggle. It is not unusual in a given day for me to work on 20 different projects during the course of a single day, many of which have tight deadlines. So that's stressful too.
Let me encourage listeners to give us a call and join in this conversation with Lee Malhado. You may call 333-9455 to access several local lines if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area where our studio is. If you're listening long distance, including on the Internet, punch in 1-800-222-9455. We have about 10 minutes, and if you keep your question short, we can probably get to two or three folks, so do give us a call. Lee, I know over your 11 years you've seen changes in what the Jewish Federation has needed to do, the new needs, the new wants. What are the trends and things you sort of see beginning to happen that the new director is going to have to deal with in the new committee?
Very good question. One of them has to do with the Jewish organizations in town, the structure and identity of these organizations. There are still six. There were six when I came, and there's six now, but they're not the same. Hadassah no longer exists. Sisterhood no longer exists. Chabad came to the community about 5 years ago, and there is going to be a new organization called JET, which is a pretty orthodox educational effort that's going to be coming to town. So the number of organizations has changed. It has remained constant, but the number of Jewish professionals has dramatically increased. It's more than doubled. When I started, there were only about eight Jewish professionals in town. Now there are 18. And that has created a lot more interactions that occur.
What do you mean, 18 Jewish professionals?
Well, like if you count all the rabbis in town, there are now three rabbis plus one who is emeritus.
I see.
When I came, there was only one. No, there were two. There was one at Hillel and one at Sinai. So now there are four. The amount of programming that's going on both at Hillel and at Chabad is vastly greater than it was. I'll give you an example.
And Chabad is spelled
C-H-A-B-A-D. Yeah, it's an acronym.
Yes.
Give you an example of how the programming has increased. When I got here, if you counted every service and every movie and every party and every lecture that was Jewish in Champaign-Urbana 11 years ago, it was 434. Last year, it was over 1,400.
Wow.
And much of that programming is a result of new money coming into Hillel from Chicago. The budget at Hillel is about three times what it was when I got here, and money coming in through Chabad.
The new Jewish Center on campus of Jewish Studies.
That's just where I was going to go.
Yeah.
So you've got almost as much money in Jewish programming in Champaign-Urbana that is funded by and driven by and instigated by interest in Chicago as you do locally. And that's created a lot of different dynamics.
Sure.
It's a wonderfully rich and exciting, but it's also really altered the whole playing field. So that's something to deal with.
So it's a very busy Jewish scene in Champaign-Urbana in spite of there being only 600 families.
Right.
Locally. So, plus 3,500 Jewish students.
Yeah. But there's serious ways in which we're over-programmed. The best example I can think of, the most ridiculous example, was this happened about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. There were, on the same night, at the same time, there was a Jewish movie being shown at Chabad. There was one being shown by Jewish Studies. There was one being shown by Hillel. And then there was one being shown by the Yiddish program. So instead of having 30 people at one movie, you had like six people at four movies. And it dilutes things to the point that it gets ridiculous.
And there isn't one organization that can kind of organize it all.
No. Federation tries very hard to be an umbrella to bring these organizations together to cooperate and to think about scheduling. When I started, that was easily done. All the organizations in town wanted to do that. They didn't have the resources available to do things independently. They had to cooperate. Now, with all this money coming in from Chicago, people are much more independent. And it's like, well, I don't care what's happening at Sinai tonight because we're serving the students. We're not serving the local community. Or I don't care what's happening at Jewish Studies because we're none of the people that we serve are going there. It's hard to pull the community together as a unit now. And that's another challenge that she will face, the new director will face.
As a representative of a religious community that does many varied things, responds to needs, helps other agencies, raises money, coordinates, as you said, helps publicize things, are there characteristics of not just the Jewish community, but any religious community that you've had so much experience with Muslims, with Christians, with Protestants, with Catholics, that you've noticed that's different than, say, working with scientists as a group? Or do religious people have certain characteristics that make them different? Are they more or less forgiving? Are they less rational? Are they, you know, the atheists?
I can't quite slice the pie the way you're asking me to, but there are some generalizations that I can make.
Okay.
I do find that among the people who are religious leaders in town, that there are two, I would say, opposing trends. One is that a lot of the people are in religious service because they really care about people and they're very sensitive and thoughtful and sometimes overly intellectual, but they're really loving people. There's another trend, which is that there are a lot of people in this group like to be on stage and like to be in control. And actually, I think that division is very common in social work, too.
Huh.
I don't think that division is that extreme in science, although you do have the posers and the, you know, you've got the people who want to be the stars in chemistry, too, and then you've got the people who just want to do their work. But you don't have a lot of people in chemistry who are in the field because they're sensitive to human needs. That's a different group of folks. I do think that there's a big difference in the Jewish community and the Protestant community that I grew up in that is both good and bad. One of the things that drove me nuts in my family of origin was that nobody ever really talked about what was going on. Nobody ever really spoke the truth. It was very polite, but getting to the bottom of something was sometimes quite difficult. This is never a problem in the Jewish community. They tell you exactly what they think all the time. And that's wonderful because you know exactly where you stand.
Sure.
It can be crazy-making because the entire Jewish community treats the leaders and each other as though you're family.
Sure.
And they say to you things that you would not expect to be told in ways that you would not expect to hear them. So,
very frank.
Very frank, very frank. And I still kind of like that.
Now, you as a scientist who've now had a leadership position for these years in the Jewish Federation, what do you make of people who are so critical of religious folks from a scientific basis? I was thinking of, well, on a very popular level, Penn and Teller, you know, they just make fun of religion all the time on TV and in their syndicated.
They make fun of science too.
Yeah, but if it comes between the two, oh well, science is of course true and religion is all nonsense.
Yeah.
But how do you somehow accept both?
To me, there's no contradiction at all. I mean, I realize there are people who could argue with me
sure.
and make me look ridiculous, but my personal way of dealing with all of this is that, to me, they're completely different realms. Science is about the physical world. It's about if you believe in God, it's about how God made it. The laws of physics, the laws of biology, the laws of chemistry, they're made by God. But you don't deal with God when you're working with them. You deal with the real natural world, and that's the only source of legitimacy. Mm. Religion to me is about the spirit. It's about meaning. It's about the heart. It's not about factual, analytical things. And so I deal with them as there are different aspects of being human, and they don't collide. That's not how everybody sees it, sure. But that's how I see it.
Hmm. Now, your spouse is also a scientist, studies the history of science. And
he would probably call himself a historian.
Historian, yeah. Okay. But whose focus is?
Right. He has a bachelor's degree in chemistry, but he thinks of himself as a historian.
Historian, okay. I'll bet you have some interesting discussions over the years.
Oh, sure.
Well, my spouse is a scientist too, and I've been interested when I go to conferences with her over the years, sitting around with people after the formal talks at dinner or something, that when people find out I'm a minister, they immediately start asking. They often reveal that, you know, these microbiologists or biochemists or whatever also are people of faith, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Hindu, whatever. But they also often say, well, that doesn't affect the way I do science, but that affects who I am as a person. And sometimes we get into discussions about whether their values, their religious values, put limits on science. In other words, are they perhaps more honest? Are they perhaps more willing to share? Are they, you know, those sorts of things. Have you ever seen that?
Well, I never dealt with a type of science where that was a personal decision, but I could see that in some biological things or during the Vietnam War about napalm. I mean, there are projects that I personally would not want to have worked on.
Sure.
But, you know, I feel that way about some social work issues too. You know, at the time I was working in social work, there were government mandates because it was government money about what could and couldn't be told to teenagers or pregnant women about abortion or birth control.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, to me, that's an intrusion of religion into public life, but that's not how everybody sees it. So I think those kinds of conflicts can occur in both realms.
We're going to need to stop here. We are out of time, but I want to thank our guest, Lee Malhado, the executive director, about to retire from the Jewish Federation of Champaign-Urbana, for her 11 years in leadership in this very important position in our community. Appreciated her concern for interfaith dialogue and working together on projects, and personally thank her for her work. I'm Steve Shoemaker, and thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.